Anyone has a mic? Go ahead.
Do you want me to choose?
Yes, you choose. They're asking you the questions, not me.
I see a few people I would rather not take questions from. Sorry, Marcos.
I know.
This is a hard question.
Please step away from the speaker.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve, start with you.
What you proposed looks really interesting, really terrific, and from the recording engineer's standpoint, it looks really exhausting. So, and the question is, have you considered that as you assembled this?
We have considered it. We believe in treating our engineers well, giving them breaks.
Is that what the black coffee was for?
I might ask, Mark, do you want to make a comment on that? Do you find it exhausting? I think at times he probably does, but we're
certainly in the middle of this process of experimenting with different configurations of that workflow and the hardware and the monitoring environment. And it also has to do with media length, you know, face time. And I certainly managed to develop a couple models that exhausted me completely, so I kind of migrated away from those as fast as possible. But for example, the 3x3 mono cassette decks with C60 cassettes was a very engaging, not exhausting process. So that's why we presented it in this presentation, because it's something that was actually, it's orally stimulating. You're really in the acoustic environment of the recording long enough to get the feel for the spectral balance and all of that stuff, but it changes all the time. And you are engaged. You've got enough time to do your homework and your paperwork as it relates to this project, of course. So yes, there are considerations of exhaustion, but I also found that listening to 4 hours of some unspoken language that I don't understand from a bad recording was just as exhausting. So I found advantages in the parallel workflow.
Okay, other questions? Right here?
Have you experimented with playing like a DAT in the background while you did a more intensive media, like a SPK plus license?
So running just a more of a data transfer kind of idea?
Instead of homogeneous material. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. We've not experimented with that. We don't have a very big DAT collection, fortunately. So it's not a format that's high on our priority list. It needs to be high on other people's priority lists, I understand. But that's an interesting idea. We've not experimented with that.
I was just wondering where your thing behind the 6 seconds came, like how'd you come upon that number?
Here I'll defer to Mark.
Trial and error is certainly the best answer I can give.
It seems fast.
There was a lot of trial and error. I was, Mike had corresponded with his friends in Australia who are doing.
I should say, I missed this during the presentation, the idea for the Pro Tools session to automate the switching and so forth, the idea comes from IATSIS, which is the Australian Institute for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies. They were doing something similar. We've taken that idea. I think we've refined it considerably, but it does come from them.
Yeah, and we adapted it certainly to our material. But I experimented. I like the Pro Tools approach because I'm very familiar with Pro Tools, and so it allowed me to keep changing my configuration constantly and come up with ways to see how it felt. And I have to say it has a rhythm to it that seemed to work with pre-coffee break, post-coffee break. And it actually worked with speech and music. I was expecting to have to change it much more between speech material and music material, and it turned out not to be that drastic a difference. And I also really felt like I didn't want to be away from source media very long. So having like a 1 minute interval means that for 2 minutes you're not concentrating your primary focus on a particular transfer. I felt that was too long. So I wanted to see how short I could make it without driving myself nuts. I thought 6 seconds was actually very engaging all the time. And I expected it to change more, and it hasn't. So, but it's still under process.
Yeah, Brad.
Two quick ones. The first one is I noticed you were assigning tapes with noise reduction to the one-to-one room, and I want to know why.
Yeah.
And the second one is you were also mentioning azimuth, adjusting azimuth. How are you doing that on those cassette decks?
Okay, well, to take the noise reduction question first, noise reduction is very level dependent, and if you've had problems with your tapes deteriorating, you may have Dolby mistracking going on. To actually transfer those which we do not have much experience doing this, so I'm talking theoretically. To transfer those, you need to ride the level to get the Dolby not to miss track. And it can be a real problem. It just doesn't seem to lend itself to a parallel transfer situation. But that's a preliminary judgment. As I said, we actually have not spent much effort trying to transfer Dolby encoded cassettes yet.
Are you doing it with the Dolby position off for all tapes?
No.
So if you know it has Dolby, you're actually transferring it with the Dolby on.
We're actually at the moment avoiding Dolby tapes
altogether.
And putting that little bit of research to figure out what to do with them later. It will become an issue because I just donated my collection to the archives. Field work that I did, which was on high bias tapes encoded in Dolby C. Ouch.
And the azimuth.
Azimuth. Oh, those task cams?
Yeah.
It's easy. Mark, do you want to describe?
Yeah. Mechanically, there is a screw that roughly corresponds to our concept of azimuth. So
our concept.
But we don't use the machines for recording anymore. So if we're messing with the azimuth as it relates to the recording part of the head, that's not a big deal.
So you're adjusting the next three machines for azimuth while the first three are playing?
Yes.
How do you do that? In other words, if you're monitoring the one that you're dumping every 6 seconds, how do you set up the other three while those are going up at the same time?
That is a headphone operation.
Uh-huh.
So there is a moment.
You also have a scope hooked up?
Yes.
So you can send the scope to the headphone jacks so that you can hear and see that, and then flip it back to the main monitoring one that you're dumping.
In our particular hardware situation, I've got a monitoring switcher that accommodates some of that, and I've built a headphone patch port that I can go from deck to deck that I can also sum to mono so that I can listen to the sum of the two channels in the headphones and do azimuth even on a mono cassette.
All right, but then I have a question for you then. If you have the headphones on adjusting for that azimuth, you're not listening to what you're dumping in. That's bouncing around to the three speakers in that area.
That's exactly right, and that's a little bit of greater risk. There is some risk involved in this. Yeah,
that's a major problem.
It's a risk.
Right.
Okay, Bruce?
One more question. I would like Rob to
feel things. Are you not yet doing reel-to-reel?
We have not yet gotten to the reel-to-reel portion of this. Yeah. That's coming up next.
Okay.
Yes.
Are you
planning
to do two sides at once?
We're talking about doing bidirectional, yeah.
I'll tell you what. Thank you, Mike. Let Rob have the field now if it's okay. And if we have some more time, we can go back to it.
Okay.
Please step away from the speaker, sir.
This is not an engineering question, so maybe it will clear the room, but it is one of these things that comes up on these, talking about access, and you did mention the metadata. And these systems tend to be very wonderful for the structural metadata and, sometimes administrative. The descriptive, in my opinion, as a catalog librarian, which also you can call me a metadata librarian, are sometimes not as much. I'm wondering in the workflow, and what I mean by not as much, and it depends on the collection you're dealing with. For things, say, of a more classical nature, how many ways is Tchaikovsky slathered on the tape or something? How many ways is lots of names? If there's any authority work to these things. How many is the Joe Smith trumpeter the same guy that you put up, if you do a keyword search that it will come up with multiple hits for different, people. So there's the authority thing, and then there's also other types of access points that don't tend to make it through just simple inputting XML and sort of thing. So I do wonder, many times these records are the only record of the item in the archive.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, it seems a shame that those access points are not addressed. That we have great file names and we have, as I said, great structural. instructional metadata, but sometimes the descriptive in the workflow, not so much. So I don't know how you all.
When I listed descriptive metadata there, I was more involved in the type of descriptive metadata that a transfer engineer would deal with in terms of the physical aspects of the actual media. So I don't think any of them are charged with describing, for example, the content outside of technical issues. So, you know, the whether it's a Tchaikovsky symphony or whatever, that's not their role, and that would be, I assume, be done by a librarian.
I would see that work getting done post-digitization.
I mean, that's what I would think, too. But that's your only chance.
Steve?
All right, I'll ask you the embarrassing question. Expense.
Okay, well, that's a tough question because...
I realize that it's a group of components.
It's highly modular. There's something like 40 modules just in Dobbin for doing, you know, the different processing. They're all priced differently. Hell, I barely got through that thing. I don't have a memory.
For a working system.
What is the working system doing? Is it ingesting from cassette? Is it doing reel to reel?
Just ingesting from cassette. A ballpark so that people have some idea of whether this is something they might consider, might dream about, or
well,
might come by
and a Dobbin's.
I think
the context is definitely what you're doing with the performance cost ratio and what you're doing with it, and
I'd still like to hear a number.
Well, once again, unless I define exactly.
Let's say it's the cassette program that you add up there.
Okay, a cassette ingest module. Probably, if you're just doing the ingest portion with Quadriga, it's probably about 20,000.
That helps.
Yeah.
On the
that includes the computer, which is a pretty hefty workstation.
You have to write your own
keyboard. No, actually, it comes from Dell.
What portion of that then is the computer? Because then
the workstation itself is about $6,000 or $7,000, and usually we interact with the customer to determine. Well, we have a base requirement for because it's a high performance machine, and then after that you're free to configure it the way you want, and that's just done on the Dell website. So if that helps. Right. Atari builds a new cassette deck that actually has that frequency response, that does a 4X. It's got two decks. It's based on their commercial industrial tape dubbing systems from years ago. It's about $9,000. So it's an expensive device. The example I said I had in my presentation was a 2X, and we know some guys that are actually using PortaStudio devices that do double speed playback with, and you've got your four outputs. So, you know, Tascam or Yamaha has those devices for doing four channel playback at double speed, and they're very inexpensive. You can't buy them brand new, admittedly, but there is that option. After that, there's reel-to-reel, quarter-track tape, reel-to-reel. And that it's obviously possible with those devices as well.
But you also then have to hot rod the playback electronics.
Yes. Well, what we tend to do on high-speed playback is recommend that you disable the playback equalization. So that happens post in the in monitoring on the fly, and then post as a process through Dobbin to create your preservation master.
So you don't have actually a program in there that will nullify it. You actually have to go in and disable it physically.
The program to nullify the equalizer in the cassette deck?
To,
no, we're talking about on the device. Well, then you're throwing two EQs, and if you caught the thing the other day, I'm not sure if that's a good idea, but
one question.
Go ahead.
The D word, how are you handling Dolby, or is that just not?
Dolby does not license that certain codecs right now, so we're sort of stuck on that. The only Dolby encoder that we have is AC3 for our Dobbin, and I'm pretty sure QTech has asked. So this is a question. I believe there was a Dolby guy around Bill.
Yeah.
Bruce? Oh, sorry.
I'll tell you what, Ed, if you want to ask them on your own, I want to thank you all. Believe it or not, it's time for lunch.
Thank you, gentlemen.